Eb stalks back into the room with an overhead projector dangling from one hand, looking for a moment like Beowulf, brandishing a monster's severed arm. He puts it on the table and aims it at the wall. There is no need for a screen because above the ubiquitous power strips, every wall in the house is covered with whiteboards. Many of the whiteboards are, in turn, covered with cryptical incantations, written in primary colors. Some of them are enclosed in irregular borders and labeled Do Not Erase, or simply DNE, or No. In front of where Eb has put the overhead projector, there is a grocery list, a half-erased fragment of a flowchart, a fax number in Russia, a couple of dotted quads, internet addresses, and a few words in German, which were presumably written by Eb himself. Dr. Eberhard Fuhrer scans all of this, finds that none of it is enclosed in a DNE border, and wipes it away with an eraser. Two more men come into the room, deeply involved in a conversation about some exasperating company in Burlingame. One of them is dark and lean and looks like a gunfighter. He even wears a black cowboy hat. The other is tubby and blonde and looks like he just got out of a Rotary Club meeting. They have one detail in common. Each is wearing a bright silver bracelet on his wrist. Randy takes the NDAs out of the printers and passes them out, two copies each pair pre-printed with a name. Randy Waterhouse, Eberhard Fuhrer, John Cantrell, the guy in the black cowboy hat, and Tom Howard, the fair-haired middle American. As John and Tom reach for the pages, the silver bracelets intercept stray beams of light sneaking through the blinds. Each is printed with a red caduceus and several lines of text.
"Those look new," Randy says. "Did they change the wording again?"
"Yeah,"
John Cantrell says.
"This is version 6.0, just out last week."
Anywhere else, the bracelets would mean that John and Tom were suffering from some sort of life-threatening condition, such as an allergy to common antibiotics. A medic hauling them out of a wrecked car would see the bracelet and follow the instructions. But this is Silicon Valley, and different rules apply. The bracelets say, on one side, "In case of death, see reverse for biostasis protocol. Follow instructions. Collect reward, $100,000. And on the other, "Call now for instructions. 1-800. Push 50,000 U heparin 4 and do CPR while cooling with ice to 10 degrees centigrade. Keep pH 7.5. No autopsy or embalming." It is a recipe for freezing a dead or nearly dead person. People who wear this bracelet believe that if this recipe is followed, the brain and other delicate tissues can be iced without destroying them. A few decades down the line, when nanotechnology has made it possible to be immortal, they hope to be thawed out. John Cantrell and Tom Howard believe that there is a reasonable chance that they will still be having conversations with each other 1 million years from now. The room gets quiet as all of the men scan the forms, their eyes picking out certain familiar clauses. They have probably signed 100 NDA forms between them. Around here, it is like offering someone a cup of coffee. A woman comes into the room, burdened with tote bags, and beams an apology for being late. Beryl Hagen looks like a Norman Rockwell aunt, an apron-wearing, apple-pie-toting type. In 20 years, she's been the chief financial officer of 12 different small high-tech companies. 10 of them have gone out of business. Except in the case of the second one, this was through no fault of Beryl's. The sixth was Randy's second business foray. One was absorbed by Microsoft. One became a successful independent company in its own right. Beryl made enough money from the latter two to retire. She consults and writes while she looks for something interesting enough to draw her back into action, and her presence in this room suggests that Epiphyte 2 Corp. must not be completely bogus. Or maybe she's just being polite to Abby. Randy gives her a bear hug, lifting her off the floor, and then hands her two copies of the NDA with her name on them. Abby has detached the screen from his big laptop and laid it flat on the surface of the overhead projector, which shines light through the liquid crystal display and projects a color image on the whiteboard. It is a typical desktop, a couple of terminal windows and some icons. Abby goes around and picks up the signed NDAs, scans them all, hands one copy back to each person, files the rest in the outer pocket of a laptop bag. He begins to type on the laptop's keyboard, and letters spill across one of the windows.
"Just so you know," Avi mumbles, "Epiphyte Corp., which I'll call Epiphyte One for clarity, is a Delaware corporation, 1.5 years old. The shareholders are myself, Randy, and Springboard Capital. We're in the telecoms business in the Philippines. I can give you details later if you want. Our work there has positioned us to be aware of some new opportunities in that part of the world. Epiphyte Two is a California corporation, 3 weeks old. If things go the way we are hoping they will go, Epiphyte One will be folded into it according to some kind of stock transfer scheme, the details of which are too boring to talk about now."
Avi hits the return key. A new window opens on the desktop. It is a color map, scanned in from an atlas, tall and narrow. Most of it is oceanic blue. A rugged coastline juts in through the top border with a few cities labeled Nagasaki, Tokyo. Shanghai is in the upper left corner. The Philippine archipelago is dead center. Taiwan is directly north of it. And to the south is a chain of islands forming a porous barrier between Asia and a big landmass labeled with English words like Darwin and Great Sandy Desert.
"This probably looks weird to most of you," Avi says. "Usually these presentations begin with a diagram of a computer network or a flow chart or something. We don't normally deal with maps. We're also used to working in a purely abstract realm that it seems almost bizarre to go out into the real world and physically do something. But I like maps. I've got maps all over my house. I'm going to suggest to you that the skills and knowledge we have all been developing in our work, especially pertaining to the Internet, have applications out here." He taps the whiteboard. "In the real world. You know, the big round wet ball where billions of people live."
There is a bit of polite snickering as Avi skims his hand over his computer's trackball, whacks a button with his thumb. A new image appears. The same map, with bright color lines running across the ocean, looping from one city to the next, roughly following the coastlines.
"Existing undersea cables. The fatter the line, the bigger the pipe," Avi says. "Now, what is wrong with this picture?"
There are several fat lines running east from places like Tokyo, Hong Kong, and Australia, presumably connecting them with the United States. Across the South China Sea, which lies between the Philippines and Vietnam, another fat line angles roughly north-south, but it doesn't connect either of those two countries. It goes straight to Hong Kong, then continues up the China coast to Shanghai, Korea, and Tokyo.
"Since the Philippines are in the center of the map," John Cantrell says, "I predict that you're going to point out that hardly any fat lines go to the Philippines."
"Hardly any fat lines go to the Philippines," Avi announces briskly.
He points out the one exception, which runs from Taiwan south to northern Luzon, then skips down the coast to Corregidor.
"Except for this one, which Epiphyte One is involved with. But it's not just that. There is a general paucity of fat lines in a north-south direction, connecting Australia with Asia. A lot of data packets going from Sydney to Tokyo have to be routed through California. There's a market opportunity."
Beryl breaks in.
"Avi, before you get started on this," she says,
sounding cautious and regretful,
"I have to say that laying long-distance deep-sea cables is a difficult business to break into."
"Beryl is right," Avi says. "The only people who have the wherewithal to lay those cables are AT&T, Cable and Wireless, and Kokusai Denshin Denwa. It's tricky, it's expensive, it requires massive NRE.
The abbreviation stands for non-recoverable expenses, meaning engineering work to complete a feasibility study that would be money down the toilet if the idea didn't fly.
"So what are you thinking?"
Beryl says.
Avi clicks up another map. This one is the same as the previous, except that new lines have been drawn in, a whole series of short island-to-island links, a bewilderingly numerous chain of short hops down the length of the Philippine archipelago.
"You want to wire the Philippines and pass them into the net via your existing link to Taiwan," says Tom Howard,
in a heroic bid to short-circuit what he senses will be a lengthy part of Avi's presentation.
The Philippines are going to be hot shit, informationally speaking, Abby says. The government has its flaws, but basically is a democracy modeled after Western institutions. Unlike most Asians, they do ASCII. Most of them speak English. Long-standing ties to the United States. These guys are going to be big players sooner or later in the information economy. Randy breaks in.
We've already established a foothold there. We know the local business environment, and we have cash flow.
Abby clicks up another map. This one's harder to make out. It looks like a relief map of a vast region of high mountains interrupted by occasional plateaus. Its appearance in the middle of this presentation without any labels or explanation from Avi makes it an implicit challenge to the mental acumen of the other people in the room. None of them is going to ask for help anytime soon. Randy watches them squint and tilt their heads from side to side. Eberhard Fuhr, who is good at odd puzzles, gets it first.
Southeast Asia, with the oceans drained, he says. That high ridge on the right is New Guinea. Those bumps are the volcanoes of Borneo.
Pretty cool, huh? Abby says. It's a radar map. U.S. military satellites gathered all this data. You can get it for next to nothing. On this map, the Philippines can be understood not as a chain of separate islands, but as the highest regions of a huge oblong plateau surrounded by deep gashes in the Earth's crust. To get from Luzon up to Taiwan by going across the ocean floor, you would have to plunge into a deep trench, flanked by parallel mountain ranges, and follow it northwards for about 300 miles. But south of Luzon, in the region where Abby is proposing to lay a network of inter-island cables, it's all shallow and flat. Abby clicks again, superimposing transparent blue over the parts that are below sea level, green on islands. Then he zooms in on an area in the center of the map, where the Philippine Plateau extends two arms southwest toward northern Borneo, embracing and nearly enclosing a diamond-shaped body of water 350 miles across.
The Sulu Sea, he announces. No relation to the token Asian on Star Trek.
No one laughs. They are not really here to be entertained. They are concentrating on the map. All of the different archipelagos and seas are confusing, even for smart people with good spatial relations. The Philippines form the upper right boundary of the Sulu Sea. North Borneo, part of Malaysia, the lower left. The Sulu Archipelago, part of the Philippines, the lower right. And the upper left boundary is one extremely long, skinny Philippine island called Palawan.
This reminds us that national boundaries are artificial and silly, Abby says. The Sulu Sea is a basin in the middle of a larger plateau shared by the Philippines and Borneo, so if you're wiring up the Philippines, you can just as easily wire Borneo up to that network at the same time, just by outlining the Sulu Sea with shallow, short-hop cables, like this.
Avi clicks again, and the computer draws in more colored lines.
Avi, why are we here? Eberhard asks.
That is a very profound question, Avi says.
We know the economics of these startups, Ebb says. We begin with nothing but the idea. That's what NDA is for, to protect your idea. We work on the idea together, put our brain power into it, and get stock in return. The result of this work is software. The software is copyrightable, trademarkable, perhaps patentable. It is intellectual property. It is worth some money. We all own it in common through our shares. Then we sell some more shares to an investor. We use the money to hire more people to turn it into a product, to market it, and so on. That's how the system works, but I'm beginning to think you don't understand it.
Why do you say that?
Ebb looks confused.
How can we contribute to this? How can we turn our brain power into equity that an investor will want to own a part of?
Everyone looks at Beryl. Beryl's nodding agreement with Ebb.
Tom Howard says, Avi, look, I can engineer big company installations. John wrote Ordo. He knows everything about crypto. Randy does internet. Ebb does weird stuff. Beryl does money. But as far as I know, none of us knows diddly about undersea cable engineering. What good will our resumes do when you go up in front of some venture capitalists?
Avi's nodding. Everything you say is true, he concedes smoothly. We would have to be crazy to get involved in running cables through the Philippines. That is a job for Philatel, with whom Epiphyte One has been joint venturing.
Even if we were crazy, Beryl says, we wouldn't have the opportunity because no one would give us the money.
Fortunately, we don't need to worry about that, Avi says, because it's being done for us.
He turns to the whiteboard, picks up a red magic marker, and draws a fat line between Taiwan and Luzon, his hands picking up a leprous mottled look from the shaded relief of the ocean floor that is being projected against his skin.
KDD, which is anticipating major growth in the Philippines, is already laying another big cable here.
He moves down and begins to draw smaller, shorter links between islands and the archipelago.
And Philatel, which is funded by AVCLA, Asia Venture Capital Los Angeles, is wiring the Philippines.
What does Epiphyte One have to do with that? Tom Howard asks. To the extent they want to use that network for internet protocol traffic, they need routers and network savvy, Randy explains. So, to repeat my question, why are we here?
Eberhard says, patiently but firmly.
Avi works with his pen for a while. He circles an island at one corner of the Sulu Sea, centered in the gap between North Borneo and the long, skinny Philippine island called Palawan. He labels it in block letters, Sultanate of Kinakuta.
Kinakuta was run by white sultans for a while. It's a long story. Then it was a German colony, Avi says. Back then, Borneo was part of the Dutch East Indies, and Palawan, like the rest of the Philippines, was first Spanish and then American. So this was the Germans' foothold in the area.
Germans always ended up holding the shittiest colonies, Ebb says ruefully.
After the First World War, they handed it over to the Japanese, along with a lot of other islands much farther to the east. All of these islands, collectively, were called the Mandates because Japan controlled them under a League of Nations mandate. During the Second World War, the Japanese used Kinakuta as a base for attacks on the Dutch East Indies and the Philippines. They retained a naval base and airfield there. After the war, Kinakuta became independent, as it had been before the Germans. The population is Muslim or ethnic Chinese around the edges, animist in the center. It has always been ruled by a sultan, even while occupied by the Germans and the Japanese, who both co-opted the sultans but kept them in place as figureheads. Kinakuta had oil reserves, but they were unreachable until the technology got better and prices went up, around the time of the Arab oil embargo, which was also when the current sultan came into power. That sultan is now a very rich man, not as rich as the sultan of Brunei, who happens to be a second cousin, but rich.
The sultan is backing your company? Beryl asks.
Not in the way you mean, Avi says.
What way do you mean?
Tom Howard asks, impatient.
Well, let me put it this way, Avi says. Kinakuta is a member of the United Nations. It is every bit as much an independent country and member of the Community of Nations as France or England. As a matter of fact, it is exceptionally independent because of its oil wealth. It is basically a monarchy. The Sultan makes the laws, but only after extensive consultations with his ministers, who set policy and draft legislation.
And I've been spending a lot of time recently with the Minister of Posts and Telecommunications. I've been helping the minister draft a new law that will govern all telecommunications passing through Kinakutan territory.
Oh my God, John Cantrell says. He is awestruck.
One free share of stock to the man in the black hat, Avi says. John has figured out Avi's secret plan. John, would you like to explain to the other contestants?
John takes his hat off and runs his hand back through his long hair. He puts his hat back on and heaves a sigh.
Avi is proposing to start a data haven, he says.
A little murmur of admiration runs through the room. Avi waits for it to subside and says,
A slight correction. The Sultan's starting the data haven. I'm proposing to make money off it.
Ultra. Lawrence Pritchard Waterhouse goes into battle armed with one-third of a sheet of British typing paper on which has been typed some words that identify it as a pass to Bletchley Park. His name and some other things have been scribbled on it in some upper-class officer's Mont Blanc blue-black. The words all sections circled, and the stamp smashed across it, blurred into a red whore's kiss, with sheer carelessness conveying greater authority and power than the specious clarity of a forger. He finds his way round the mansion to the narrow lane that runs between it and its row of red brick garages, or stables, as his grandparents would be likely to peg them. He finds it a very pleasant place for a cigarette. The lane is lined with trees, a densely planted hedge of them. The sun is just setting now. It is still high enough to snipe through any small defects that it finds in the defensive perimeter of the horizon, so narrow red beams strike him surprisingly in the eye as he ambles back and forth. He knows one is shining invisibly through the clear air several feet above him because it is betraying an aerial, a strand of copper wire stretched from the wall of the mansion to a nearby cypress. It catches the light in precisely the same way as the strand of the spider web that Waterhouse was playing with earlier. The sun will be down soon. It is already down in Berlin, as in most of the hellish empire that Hitler has built from Calais to the Volga. Time for the radio operators to begin their work. Radio does not, in general, go around corners. This can be a real pain when you are conquering the world, which is inconveniently round, placing all of your most active military units over the horizon. But if you use shortwave, then you can bounce the information off the ionosphere. This works a good deal better when the sun is not in the sky, sluicing the atmosphere with wideband noise. So radio telegraphers, and the people who eavesdrop on them, what the Brits call the Y service, are, alike, nocturnal beings. As Waterhouse has just observed, the mansion has an aerial or two. But Bletchley Park is a huge and ravenous spider that requires a web the size of a nation to feed it. He has seen enough evidence, from the black cables climbing the mansion's walls and the smell and hiss of the massed teletypes, to know that the web is at least partly made of copper wires. Another piece of the web is made of rude stuff, like concrete and asphalt. The gate swings open, and a man on a green motorcycle banks steeply into the lane, the two cylinders of his machine blatting away, the noise stinging Waterhouse's nose as he rides by. Waterhouse strides after him for some distance, but loses his trail after 100 yards or so. That is acceptable. More of them will be along soon, as the Wehrmacht's nervous system awakens and its signals are picked up by the Y service. The motorcyclist went through a quaint little gate that joins two old buildings. The gate is topped by a tiny cupola, with a weather vane and a clock. Waterhouse goes through it and finds himself in a little square that evidently dates back to when Bletchley Park was a precious Buckinghamshire farmstead. To the left, the line of stables continues. Small gables have been set into the roof, which is stained with bird shit. The building is quivering with pigeons. Directly in front of him is a nice little red brick Tudor farmhouse, the only thing he has seen so far that is not architecturally offensive. Off to his right is a one-story building. Strange information is coming out of this building. The hot oil smell of teletypes, but no typing noises, just a high mechanical whine. A door opens on the stable building, and a man emerges, carrying a large but evidently lightweight box with a handle on the top. Cooing noises come from the box, and Waterhouse realizes that it contains pigeons. Those birds living up in the gables are not feral. They are homing pigeons. Carriers of information, strands of Bletchley Park's web. He homes in on the building that smells of hot oil and gazes into a window. As evening falls, light has begun to leak out of it, betraying information to black German reconnaissance planes. So a porter is strutting about the courtyard, slamming the black shutters closed. Some information comes into Waterhouse's eyes, at least. On the other side of that window, men are gathered around a machine. Most of them are wearing civilian clothes, and they have been too busy for too long to trifle much with combs and razors and shoe polish. The men are intensely focused upon their work, which all has to do with this large machine. The machine consists of a large framework of square steel tubing, like a bedstead set up on one end. Metal drums with the diameter of dinner plates, an inch or so thick, are mounted at several locations on this framework. Paper tape has been threaded in a bewilderingly loopy trajectory from drum to drum. It looks as if a dozen yards of tape are required to thread the machine. One of the men has been working on a rubber drive belt that goes around one of the drums. He steps back from it and makes a gesture with his hand. Another man flips a switch, and the drums all begin to spin at once. The tape begins to fly through the system. Holes punched in the tape carry data. It all blurs into a gray streak now, the speed creating an illusion in which the tape appears to dissolve into a ribbon of smoke. No, it is not an illusion. Real smoke is curling up from the spinning drums. The tape is running through the machine so fast that it is catching fire before the eyes of Waterhouse and the men inside, who watch it calmly, as if it were smoking in an entirely new and interesting way. If there is a machine in the world capable of reading data from a tape that fast, Waterhouse has never heard of it. The black shutter slams home. Just as it does, Waterhouse gets one fragmentary glimpse of another object standing in the corner of the room, a steel rack in which a large number of gray cylindrical objects are stored in neat rows. Two motorcyclists come through the courtyard at once, running in the darkness with their headlights off. Waterhouse jogs after them for a bit, leaving the picturesque old courtyard behind and entering into the world of the huts, the new structures thrown up in the last year or two. Hut makes him think of a tiny thing, but these huts, taken together, are more like that new Pentagon thing that the War Department has been putting up across the river from D.C. They embody a blunt need for space, unfiltered through any aesthetic or even human considerations. Waterhouse walks to an intersection of roads where he thought he heard the motorcycles making a turn and stops, hemmed in by blast walls. On an impulse, he clambers to the top of a wall and takes a seat. The view from here is no better. He knows that thousands of people are at work all around him in these huts, but he sees none of them. There are no signposts. He is still trying to work out that business that he saw through the window. The tape was running so fast that it smoked. There is no point of driving it that fast unless the machine can read the information that fast, transforming the pattern of holes in the tape into electrical impulses. But why bother, if those impulses had nowhere to go? No human mind could deal with a stream of characters coming in at that speed. No teletype that Waterhouse knew of could even print them out. It only makes sense if they are constructing a machine, a mechanical calculator of some sort that can absorb the data and then do something with it, perform some calculation, presumably a cipher-breaking type of calculation. Then he remembers the rack he glimpsed in the corner, its many rows of identical gray cylinders. Viewed end-on, they looked like some kind of ammunition, but they are too smooth and glossy for that. Those cylinders, Waterhouse realizes, are made of blown glass. They are vacuum tubes, hundreds of them, more tubes in one place than Waterhouse has ever seen. Those men in that room are building a Turing machine. It is no wonder, then, that the men in the room accept the burning of the tape so calmly. That strip of paper, a technology as old as the pyramids, is merely a vessel for a stream of information. When it passes through the machine, the information is abstracted from it, transfigured into a pattern of pure binary data. That the mere vessel burns is of no consequence. Ashes to ashes, dust to dust, the data has passed out of the physical plane and into the mathematical, a higher and purer universe where different laws apply. Laws, a few of which are dimly and imperfectly known to Dr. Alan Matheson Turing and Dr. John von Neumann and Dr. Rudolf von Haeckelheber and a few other people Waterhouse used to hang around with in Princeton. Laws about which Waterhouse himself knows a thing or two. Once you have transfigured the data into the realm of pure information, all that is required is a tool. Carpenters work with wood and carry a box of technology for measuring it, cutting it, smoothing it, joining it. Mathematicians work with information and need a tool of their own. They have been building these tools one at a time for years. There is, just to name one example, a cash register and typewriter company called the Electrical Till Corporation that makes a dandy punched card machine for tabulating large quantities of data. Waterhouse's professor in Iowa was tired of solving differential equations one at a time and invented a machine to solve them automatically by storing the information on a capacitor-covered drum and cranking through a certain algorithm. Given enough time and enough vacuum tubes, a tool might be invented to sum a column of numbers, and another one to keep track of inventories, and another one to alphabetize lists of words. A well-equipped business would have one of each, gleaming cast-iron monsters with heat waves rising out of their grills, emblazoned with logos like ETC and Siemens and Hollerith, each carrying out its own specialized task. Just as a carpenter had a miter box and a dovetail jig and a claw hammer in his box. Turing figured out something entirely different, something unspeakably strange and radical. He figured out that mathematicians, unlike carpenters, only needed to have one tool in their toolbox, if it were the right sort of tool. Turing realized that it should be possible to build a metamachine that could be reconfigured in such a way that it would do any task you could conceivably do with information. It would be a protean device that could turn into any tool you could ever need. Like a pipe organ, changing into a different instrument every time you hit a preset button. The details were a bit hazy. This was not a blueprint for an actual machine, rather a thought experiment that Turing had dreamed up in order to resolve an abstract riddle from the completely impractical world of pure logic. Waterhouse knows this perfectly well, but he cannot get one thing out of his mind as he sits there atop the blast walls at the dark intersection in Bletchley Park. The Turing machine, if one really existed, would rely upon having a tape. The tape would pass through the machine. It would carry the information that the machine needed to do its work. Waterhouse sits there staring off into the darkness and reconstructs Turing's machine in his mind. More of the details are coming back to him. The tape, he now recollects, would not move through the Turing machine in one direction. It would change direction frequently, and the Turing machine would not just read the tape. It would be able to erase marks or make new ones. Clearly, you cannot erase holes in a paper tape. And just as clearly, the tape only moves through this Bletchley Park machine in one direction. So, much as Waterhouse hates to admit this fact to himself, the rack of tubes he just spied is not a Turing machine. It is some lesser device, a special-purpose tool like a punched card reader or Atanasoff's differential equation solver. It is still bigger and more fiendishly terrific than anything Waterhouse has ever seen. A night train from Birmingham blows through, carrying bullets to the sea. As its sound dies away to the south, a motorcycle approaches the park's main gate. Its engine idles as the rider's papers are checked, then Waterhouse hears a Bronx cheer as it surges forward and cuts the sharp turn into the lane. Waterhouse climbs to his feet at the intersection of the walls and watches carefully as the bike sputters past him and homes in on a hut a couple of blocks away. Light suddenly leaks from an open door as the cargo changes hands. Then the light is snuffed, and the bike stretches a long, loud raspberry down the road to the park's exit. Waterhouse lets himself down to earth and gropes his way down to the road through the moonless night. He stops before the entrance to the hut and listens to it teem for a minute. Then, working up his courage, he steps forward and pushes the wooden door open. It is unpleasantly hot in here, and the atmosphere is a nauseating distillation of human and machine odors, held in and concentrated by the coffin door slabbed down over all the windows. Many people are in here, mostly women, working at gargantuan electrically powered typewriters. He can see, even through his squint, that the place is a running sluice for scraps of paper, maybe 4 by 6 inches each, evidently brought in by the motorcyclists. Near the door they have been sorted and stacked up in wire baskets. Thence they go to the women at their giant typewriters. One of the few men in the place has risen to his feet and is homing in on Waterhouse. He is about Waterhouse's age, that is, in his early 20s. He is wearing a British Army uniform. He has the air of a host at a wedding reception who wants to make sure that even the most long-lost, far-flung members of the family are properly greeted. Obviously, he is no more a real military man than is Waterhouse himself. No wonder this place is surrounded by so much barbed wire and RAF men with machine guns.
Good evening, sir. Can I help you?
Evening, Lawrence Waterhouse.
Harry Packard, pleased to meet you.
But he has no idea who Waterhouse is. He is privy to Ultra, but not to Ultra Mega.
Pleasure's mine. I imagine you'll want to have a look at this.
Waterhouse hands him the magic pass. Packard's pale eyes travel over it carefully, then jump around to focus on a few sites of particular interest. The signature at the bottom, the smeared stamp. The war has turned Harry Packard into a machine for scanning and processing slips of paper, and he goes about his work calmly and without fuss in this case. He excuses himself, works the crank on a telephone, and speaks to someone. His posture and facial expression suggest it is someone important. Waterhouse cannot hear the words above the clicking and thrumming of the massed typewriters, but he sees interest and bemusement on Packard's young, open, pink face. Packard gives Waterhouse a sidelong glance or two while he is listening to the person at the other end of the line. Then he says something respectful and reassuring into the phone and rings off.
Right. Well, what would you like to see?
I'm trying to get an overall sense of how the information flows.
Well, we are close to the beginning of it here. These are the headwaters. Our wellsprings are the Y Service, military and amateur radio operators who listen in on Jerry's radio transmissions, and provide us with these.
Packard takes a slip from a motorcyclist's pannier and hands it to Waterhouse. It is a form with various boxes at the top in which someone has written in a date, today's, and time, a couple of hours ago, and a few other data, such as a radio frequency. The body of the form is mostly occupied by a large open space in which the following has been printed in hasty block letters. AYWBPROJHKDHAOBQTMDL, and so on. The whole thing preceded by two groups of three letters each. YUHABG.
This one came in from one of our stations in Kent, Packard says. It is a chaffinch message.
So, one of Rommel's?
Yes, this intercept came in from Cairo. Chaffinch gets top priority, which is why this message is on the top of the pile.
Packard leads Waterhouse down the central aisle of the hut, between the rows of typists. He picks out one girl who is just finishing up with a message and hands her the slip. She sets it up next to her machine and commences typing it in. At first glance, Waterhouse had thought that the machines represented some British concept of how to build an electric typewriter, as big as a dinner table, wrapped up in 200 pounds of cast iron, a 10-horse motor turning over under the hood, surrounded by tall fences and armed guards. But now that he is closer, he sees that it is something much more complicated. Instead of a platen, it has a large flat reel on it, carrying a roll of narrow paper tape. This is not the same kind of tape he saw earlier, smoking through the big machine. This is narrower, and when it emerges from the machine, it does not have holes punched through it for a machine to read. Instead, every time the girl slams down one of the keys on the keyboard, copying the text printed on the slip, a new letter is printed on the tape, but not the same letter that she typed. It does not take her long to type in all of the letters. Then she tears the tape from her machine. It has a sticky backing, which she uses to paste it directly onto the original intercept slip. She hands it to Packard, giving him a demure smile. He responds with something between a nod and a smart little bow, the kind of thing no American male could ever get away with. He glances at it and hands it to Waterhouse. The letters on the tape say,
21. Panzerdivision berichtet keine besondere Ereignisse.
In order to obtain those settings, you have to break the code, which changes every day.
Packard smiles in agreement.
At midnight, if you stay here, he checks his watch, for another 4 hours,
you will see fresh intercepts coming in from the Y service that will produce utter gibberish when we run them through the Typex, because the Jerrys will have changed all their codes on the stroke of midnight. Rather like Cinderella's magic carriage turning back into a pumpkin. We must then analyze the new intercepts using the bombs and figure out the day's new codes.
How long does that take?
Sometimes we are lucky and have broken the day's codes by 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning. Typically, it does not happen until afternoon or evening. Sometimes we do not succeed at all.
Okay, this is a stupid question, but I want to be clear. These Typex machines, which merely do a mechanical deciphering operation, are a completely different thing from the bombs, which actually break the codes.
The bombs, compared to these, are of a completely different, enormously higher order of sophistication, Packard agrees. They're almost like mechanical thinking machines.
Where are they located?
Hut 11. But they won't be running just now.
Right, Waterhouse says. Not until after midnight when the carriage turns back into a pumpkin and you need to break tomorrow's Enigma settings.
Precisely.
Packard steps over to a small wooden hatch set low into one of the hut's exterior walls. Next to it sits an office tray with a cup hook screwed into each end and a string tied to each cup hook. One of the strings is piled up loose on the floor. The wall hatch has been slid shut on the other string. Packard puts the message slip on top of a pile of similar ones that is accumulated in the tray, then slides the hatch open, revealing a narrow tunnel leading away from the hut.
Okay, your pull, he shouts.
Okay, my pull,
comes an answering voice a moment later. The string goes taut, and the tray slides into the tunnel and disappears.
On its way to Hut 3, Packard explains.
Ah, then so am I, Waterhouse says.
Hut 3 is only a few yards away on the other side of the inevitable blast wall. German military section has been scrawled on the door in cursive. Waterhouse presumes that this is as opposed to naval, which is in Hut 4. The ratio of men to women seems higher here. During wartime, it is startling to see so many hale young men in one room together. Some are in Army or RAF uniforms, some in civvies, and there is even one naval officer. A large horseshoe-shaped table dominates the center of the building, with a rectangular table off to the side. Each chair at each table is occupied by intent workers. The intercept slips are pulled into the hut on the wooden tray and then moved from chair to chair according to some highly organized scheme that Waterhouse can only vaguely grasp at this point. Someone explains to him that the bombs just broke the day's codes around sundown, and so the entire day's load of intercepts has just come down the tunnel from Hut 6 during the last couple of hours. He decides to think of the hut as a mathematical black box for the time being. That is, he'll concentrate only on its inputs and outputs of information and ignore the internal details. Bletchley Park, taken in its entirety, is a black box of sorts. Random letters stream into it, strategic intelligence streams out, and the internal particulars are of no interest to most of the people on the ultra-distribution list. The question that Waterhouse is here to figure out is there another vector of information coming out of this place, hidden subliminally in the teletype signals and the behaviors of the Allied commanders? And does it point to Rudolf von Hackelhaber, Ph.D.?
Kinakuta.
Whoever laid out the flight paths into the Sultan's new airport must have been in cahoots with the Kinakuta Chamber of Commerce. If you're lucky enough to be in a window seat on the left side of the plane, as Randy Waterhouse is, the view during the final approach looks like a propaganda flyby. Kinakuta's matted green slopes surge out of a mostly calm blue sea, and eventually soar high enough to be dusted with snow at the summits, even though the island is only 7 degrees north of the equator. Randy sees right away what Avi meant when he said that the place was Muslim around the edges and animist in the middle. The only places you could hope to build anything like a modern city are along the coast, where there is an intermittent fringe of nearly flat land, a beige rind clinging to a giant emerald. The biggest and best flat place is on the northeastern corner of the island, where the main river, several miles inland,
bottoms out into a floodplain that broadens to an alluvial delta that reaches out into the Sulu Sea for a mile or two. Randy gives up counting the oil rigs 10 minutes before Kinakuta City even comes into sight. From high above, they look like flaming tank traps scattered in the surf to deter incoming marines. As the plane sheds altitude, they begin to look more like factories on stilts, topped with high stacks where troublesome natural gas is flamed off. This gets more alarming as the plane gets closer to the water, and it begins to seem as if the pilot is threading his way between pillars of fire that would roast the 777 like a pigeon on the wing. Kinakuta City looks more modern than anything in the States. He has been trying to read about the place, but has found precious little. A couple of encyclopedia entries, a few fleeting mentions, and World War II histories, some puckish but basically glowing articles in The Economist. Putting his rusty interlibrary loan skills to work, he paid the Library of Congress to make him a photocopy of the one book he could find specifically about Kinakuta. One of about a million out-of-print World War II memoirs that must have been penned by GIs during the late 40s and 50s. So far, he hasn't had time to read it. And so, the 2-inch stack of pages is just dead weight in his luggage. In any case, none of the maps he has seen tallies with the reality of the modern Kinakuta City. Anything that was there during the war has been torn down and replaced with new. The river has been dredged into a new channel. An inconvenient mountain called Eliza Peak has been dynamited, and the rubble shoved into the ocean to make several new square miles of real estate, most of which has been gobbled by the new airport. The dynamitings were so loud that they prompted complaints from the governments of the Philippines and of Borneo, hundreds of miles away. They also brought down the wrath of Greenpeace, which was afraid that the Sultan was scaring whales in the Central Pacific. So Randy expects half of Kinakuta City to be a smoking crater. But of course, it's not. The stump of Eliza Peak has been neatly paved over and used as the foundation of the Sultan's new technology city. All of the glass-walled skyscrapers there and in the rest of the city have pointy tops, recalling a traditional architecture that has long since been bulldozed and used to fill in the harbor. The only building Randy can see that looks to be more than 10 years old is the Sultan's Palace, which is ancient. Surrounded by miles of blue-glass skyscrapers, it's like a reddish-beige moat frozen in a tray of ice. Once Randy fixes on that, everything snaps into its proper orientation. He bends forward, risks the censure of the cabin crew by pulling his bag out from under the seat ahead of him, and pulls out his photocopied GI memoir. One of its first pages is a map of Kinakuta City, as it appeared in 1945, and dead center is the Sultan's Palace. Randy rotates it before his face in the way of a panicky driver with a steering wheel, and gets it to line up with his view. There's the river. There's Eliza Peak, where the Nipponese used to have a signals intelligence detachment and a radar station, all built with slave labor. There's the former site of the Japanese Naval Air Force Field, which became the Kinakuta Airport until the new one was built. Now it is a flock of yellow cranes above a blue nebula of rebar, lit from within by a constellation of flickering white stars, arc welders at work. Next to it is something that doesn't belong, a patch of emerald green, maybe a couple of city blocks, surrounded by a stone wall. Inside, there's a placid pond toward one end. The 777 is now so low that Randy can count the lily pads. A tiny Shinto temple, hewn from black stone, and a little bamboo house. Randy presses his face to the window and keeps turning his head to follow it, until suddenly his view is blocked by a high-rise apartment building just off the wingtip. Through an open kitchen window, he gets a microsecond's glimpse of a slender lady swinging a hatchet towards a coconut. That garden looked like it belonged 1,000 miles farther north, in Nippon. When Randy finally realizes what it was, the hairs stand up on the back of his neck. Randy got on this plane a couple of hours ago at Ninoy Aquino International Airport in Manila. The flight was delayed, and so he had plenty of time to look at the other passengers, 3 Westerners, including himself, a couple of dozen Malay types, either Kinakutan or Filipino, and everyone else Nipponese. Some of the latter looked like businessmen, traveling on their own or in twos and threes, but most belonged to some kind of an organized tour group that marched into the boarding lounge precisely 45 minutes before scheduled takeoff, queued behind a young woman in a navy blue skirt suit holding up a neat little logo on a stick. Retirees. Their destination is not the technology city, or any of the peculiar pointy-topped skyscrapers in the financial district. They are all going to that walled Nipponese garden, which is built on top of a mass grave containing the bodies of 3,500 Nipponese soldiers, who all died on August 23, 1945. Tagum House. Waterhouse eddies up and down the quiet side street, squinting at brass plaques on sturdy white row houses. Society for the Unification of Hinduism and Islam. Anglo-Lap Solidarity Society. Fulminance Association. Xiang Qie Mutual Benevolence Society. Royal Committee on Mitigation of Marine Crankshaft Wear. Bulger Damselfly Propagation Foundation. Anti-Welch League. Committee for the Reformation of English Orthography. Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Vermin. Church of Vedantic Ethical Quantum Consciousness. Imperial Mica Board. At first, he mistakes Tagum House for the world's tiniest and most poorly located department store. It has a bow window that looms over the sidewalk like the thrusting ram of a trireme, embarnacled with Victorian foufoffery, and housing a humble display. A headless mannequin, dressed in something that appears to have been spun from steel wool, perhaps a tribute to wartime austerity, a heap of sallow dirt with a shovel in it, and another mannequin, a recent addition shoehorned into one corner, dressed in a Royal Navy uniform and holding a wooden cutout of a rifle. Waterhouse found a worm-eaten copy of the Encyclopedia Tagmiana in a bookshop near the British Museum a week ago and has been carrying it around in his attaché case since then, imbibing a page or two at a time like doses of strong medicine. The overriding themes of the encyclopedia are three, and they dominate its every paragraph as totally as the three sigras dominate the landscape of Outer Tagum. Two of these themes are wool and guano, though the Tagmians have other names for them in their ancient sui generis tongue. In fact, the same linguistic hyperspecialization occurs here that supposedly does with the Eskimos and snow, or Arabs and sand. And the Encyclopedia Tagmiana never uses the English words wool and guano, except to slander the inferior versions of these products that are exported by places like Scotland, in a perfidious effort to confuse the naive buyers who apparently dominate the world's commodity markets. Waterhouse had to read the encyclopedia almost cover to cover and use all his cryptanalytic skills to figure out, by inference, what these products actually were. Having learned so much about them, he is fascinated to find them proudly displayed in the heart of the cosmopolitan city, a mound of guano and a woman dressed in wool. He has made up his mind that he will use the English words rather than making a spectacle of himself by trying to pronounce the Tagmian ones. The woman's outfit is entirely gray, in keeping with Tagmian tradition, which scorns pigmentation as a loathsome and whorish innovation of the Scots. The top part of the ensemble is a sweater which appears, at a glance, to be made of felt. A closer look reveals that it is knit like any other sweater. Tagmian sheep are the evolutionary product of thousands of years' massive weather-related die-offs. Their wool is famous for its density, its corkscrew-like fibers, and its immunity to all known chemical straightening processes. It creates a matted effect, which the encyclopedia describes as being supremely desirable, and for which there is an extensive descriptive vocabulary. The third theme of the Encyclopedia Tagmiana is hinted at by the mannequin with the gun. Propped up against the stonework next to the building's entrance is a gaffer dressed in an antique variant of the Home Guard uniform involving knickerbockers. His lower legs are encased in formidable socks made of one of the variants of Tagmian wool and lashed in place just below the knee with tourniquets fashioned from thick cords woven together in a vaguely Celtic interlace pattern, On almost every page, the encyclopedia restates that the Tagmians are not Celts, but that they did invent the best features of Celtic culture. These garters are the traditional ornament of true Tagmians. Gentlemen wear them hidden underneath the trousers of their suits. They were traditionally made from the long, slender tails of the Skerries, which is the predominant mammal native to the islands, and which the encyclopedia defines as a small mammal of the order Rodentia and the order Muridae, common in the islands, subsisting primarily on the eggs of seabirds, capable of multiplying with great rapidity when that or any other food is made available to it, admired and even emulated by Tagmians for its hardiness and adaptability. After Waterhouse has been standing there for a few moments, enjoying a cigarette and examining those garters, this mannequin moves slightly. Waterhouse thinks that it is falling over in a gust of wind, but then he realizes that it is alive and not exactly falling over, but just shifting its weight from foot to foot. The gaffer takes note of him, smiles blackly, and utters some word of greeting in his language, which, as has already become plain, is even less suited than English to transcription into the Roman alphabet.
"Howdy,"
Waterhouse says. The gaffer says something longer and more complicated. After a while, Waterhouse, now wearing his cryptanalyst hat, searching for meaning amidst apparent randomness, his neural circuits exploiting the redundancies in the signal, realizes that the man is speaking heavily accented English. He concludes that his interlocutor was saying, "What part of the States are you from, then?" "My family's done a lot of traveling around," Waterhouse says. "Let's say South Dakota."
"Ah,"
the gaffer says ambiguously while flinging himself against the slab of door. After a while, it begins to move inwards, hand-hammered iron hinges grinding ominously as they pivot round inch-thick folds. Finally, the door collides with some kind of formidable stop. The gaffer remains leaning against it, his entire body at a 45-degree angle to prevent it swinging back and crushing Waterhouse, who scurries past. Inside, a tiny anteroom is dominated by a sculpture, two nymphettes in diaphanous veils kicking the crap out of a scurrying hag entitled "Fortitude and Adaptability, Driving Out Adversity." This operation is repeated a few times with doors that are successively lighter but more richly decorated. The first room, it becomes clear, was actually a pre-ante-penultimate room, so it is a while before they can be said to be definitely inside Tagham House. By that time, they seem to be deep in the center of the block, and Waterhouse half expects to see an underground train screech by. Instead, he finds himself in a windowless paneled room with a crystal chandelier that is painfully bright, but does not seem to actually illuminate anything. His feet sink so deeply into the gaudy carpet that he nearly blows out a ligament. The far end of the room is guarded by a staunch desk with a stout lady behind it. Here and there are large ebony Windsor chairs with the spindly but dangerous look of Aboriginal game snares. On the walls, diverse oil paintings. At a first glance, Waterhouse sorts them into ones that are higher than they are wide and others. The former category is portraits of gentlemen, all of whom seem to share a previous genetic flaw that informs the geometry of the skull. The latter category is landscapes, or just as often, seascapes, all in the bleak and rugged category. These Tagmian painters are so fond of the locally produced blue-green-gray paint that they apply it as if with the back of a shovel, according to the EQ, derived from lichen. Waterhouse fights through the miring shag of the carpet until he nears the desk, where he is greeted by the lady, who shakes his hand and pinches her face together in a sort of allusion to a smile. There is a long exchange of polite, perfunctory speech, of which all Waterhouse remembers is,
"Lord Wardmire will see you shortly,"
and
"Tea?"
Waterhouse says yes to the tea because he suspects that this lady, he has forgotten her name, is not really earning her keep. Clearly disgruntled, she ejects herself from her chair and loses herself in deeper, narrower parts of the building. The gaffer has already gone back to his post out front. A photograph of the king hangs on the wall behind the desk. Waterhouse hadn't known, until Colonel Chatton discreetly reminded him, that His Majesty's full title was not simply By the Grace of God of England King, but BTGOG of the United Kingdom of Great Britain and Northern Ireland, the Isle of Man, Guernsey, Jersey, Outer Tagum, and Inner Tagum King. Next to it is a smaller photograph of the man he is about to meet. This fellow and his family are covered rather sketchily by the encyclopedia, which is decades old, and so Waterhouse has had to do some additional background research. The man is related to the Windsors in a way so convoluted that it can only be expressed using advanced genealogical vocabulary. He was born Graf Heinrich Karl Wilhelm Otto Friedrich von Ubersessen-Seehafenstadt, but changed his name to Nigel St. John Gloamthorpe, a.k.a. Lord Wodmeyer, in 1914. In his photograph, he looks every inch of von Ubersessen-Seehafenstadt, and he is entirely free of the cranial geometry problem so evident in the older portraits. Lord Wodmeyer is not related to the original ducal line of Tagum, the Moore family, anglicized from the Tagmian clan name Menurgl, which had been terminated in 1888 by a spectacularly improbable combination of schistosomiasis, suicide, long-festering Crimean war wounds, ball lightning, flawed cannon, falls from horses, improperly canned oysters, and rogue waves. The tea takes some time in coming, and Lord Wodmeyer does not seem to be in any particular hurry to win the war either, so Waterhouse makes a circuit of the room, pretending to care about the paintings. The biggest one depicts a number of bruised and lacerated Romans dragging their sorry asses up onto a rocky and unwelcoming shore as splinters of their invasion fleet wash up around them. Front and center is a particular Roman who looks no less noble for wear and tear. He is seated wearily on a high rock, a broken sword dangling from one enervated hand, gazing longingly across several miles of rough water towards a shining, paradisiacal island. This isle is richly endowed with tall trees and flowering meadows and green pastures, but even so it can be identified as Outer Tagum by the three sigillas towering above it. The isle is guarded by a forbidding castle or two. Its pale, almost Caribbean beaches are lined with the colorful banners of a defending host, which, one can only assume, has just given the Roman invaders a bit of rough handling, which they will not soon forget. Waterhouse does not bother to bend down and squint at the plaque. He knows that the subject of the painting is Julius Caesar's failed and probably apocryphal attempt to add the Tagum Archipelago to the Roman Empire, the farthest from Rome he ever got, and the least good idea he ever had. To say that the Tagmians have not forgotten the event is like saying that Germans can sometimes be a little prickly.
Well, Caesar failed. What hope has Hitler?
Waterhouse turns towards the voice and discovers Nigel St. John Gloamthorpe, a.k.a. Lord Wodmeyer, a.k.a. the Duke of Tagum. He is not a tall man. Waterhouse goose-steps through the carpet to shake his hand. Though Colonel Chatton briefed him on proper forms of address when meeting a duke, Waterhouse can no more remember this than he can diagram the duke's family tree. So he decides to structure all of his utterances so as to avoid referring to the Duke by name or pronoun. This will be a fun game, and make the time go faster.
It is quite a painting, Waterhouse says. A heck of a deal.
You will find the islands themselves no less extraordinary, and for the same reasons,
the Duke says obliquely. The next time Waterhouse is really aware of what's going on, he is sitting in the Duke's office. He thinks that there has been some routine, polite conversation along the way, but there is never any point in actually monitoring that kind of thing. Tea is offered to him and is accepted for the second or third time, but fails to materialize. Colonel Chatton is in the Mediterranean, and I have been sent in his place, Waterhouse explains. Not to waste time covering logistical details, but to convey our enormous gratitude for the most generous offer made in regards to the castle. There. No pronouns, no gaff.
Not at all.
The Duke is taking the whole thing as an affront to his generosity. He speaks in the unhurried, dignified cadences of a man who is mentally thumbing through a German-English dictionary.
even setting aside my own patriotic obligations, cheerfully accepted, of course, it has almost become almost terribly fashionable to have a whole crew of uniformed fellows and whatnot running around in one's pantry.
Many of the great houses of Britain are doing their bit for the war. Waterhouse agrees.
Well, by all means, then, use it,
the Duke says.
Don't be reticent. Use it thoroughly. Give it a good working over. It has survived a thousand Tagum winters, and it will survive your worst.
We hope to have a small detachment in place very soon, Waterhouse says agreeably.
May I know, to satisfy my own curiosity, what sort of...
The Duke says and trails off. Waterhouse is ready for this. He is so ready that he has to hold back for a moment and try to make a show of discretion. Huff Duff.
Huff Duff?
HFDF, high-frequency direction finding, a technique for locating distant radio transmitters by triangulating from several points.
I should have thought you knew where all the German transmitters were.
We do, except for the ones that move.
Move?
The Duke furrows his brow tremendously, imagining a giant radio transmitter, building, tower and all, mounted on four parallel railroad tracks like Big Bertha, creeping across a steppe drawn by harnessed Ukrainians. Think U-boats, Waterhouse says delicately.
Ah!
The Duke says explosively.
Ah!
He leans back in his creaky leather chair, examining a whole new picture with his mind's eye.
They pop up, do they, and send out a wireless...
They do.
And you eavesdrop.
If only we could, Waterhouse says. No, the Germans have used all of that world-famous mathematical brilliance of theirs to invent ciphers that are totally unbreakable. We don't have the first idea what they are saying, but by using Huff Duff, we can figure out where they are saying it from and route our convoys accordingly.
Ah!
So what we propose to do is mount big rotating antennas, or aerials, as you call them here, on the castle and staff the place with Huff Duff boffins. The Duke frowns.
There will be safeguards for lightning?
Naturally.
And you are aware that you may anticipate ice storms as late in the year as August?
The Royal Tagum Meteorological Station's reports as a body of work. And don't leave a heck of a lot to the imagination.
Fine, then.
The Duke blusters, warming to the concept.
Use the castle, then, and give them... Give them hell.
Electrical Till Corporation. As evidence of the Allies' slowly developing plan to kill the Axis by smothering them under a mountain of manufactured goods... There's this one pier in Sydney Harbor that is piled high with wooden crates and steel barrels, stuff that has been disgorged from the holds of ships from America, Britain, India, and just left to sit there because Australia doesn't know how to digest it yet. It is not the only pier in Sydney that is choked with stuff, but because this pier isn't good for much else, it is mounted higher and the stuff is older, rustier, more infested with rats, more rimed with salt... more thickly frosted and flagrantly streaked with gull shit. A man is picking his way over the pile, trying not to get any more of that gull shit on his khakis. He is wearing the uniform of a major in the United States Army and is badly encumbered by a briefcase. His name is Comstock. Inside the briefcase are various identity papers, credentials, and an impressive letter from the office of the General in Brisbane. Comstock has had occasion to show all of the above to the doddering and yet queerly formidable Australian guards who, with their doughboy helmets and rifles, infest the waterfront. These men do not speak any dialect of the English language that the Major can recognize, and vice versa, but they can all read what is on those papers. The sun is going down and the rats are waking up. The Major has been clambering over docks all day long. He has seen enough of war and the military to know that what he is looking for will be found on the last pier that he searches, which happens to be this one. If he begins searching that pier at the near end, what he is looking for will be at the far end, and vice versa. All the more reason to stay sharp as he works his way along. After casting an eye around to make sure there are no leaking stacks of drums of aviation fuel nearby, he lights up a cigarette. War is hell, but smoking cigarettes makes it all worthwhile. Sydney Harbor is beautiful at sunset, but he's been looking at it all day and can't really see it anymore. For lack of anything better to do, he opens up his briefcase. There's a paperback novel in there, which he's already read, and there is a clipboard which contains, in yellowed, crackling, sedimentary layers, a fossil record that only an archaeologist could unravel. It is the story of how the General, just after he got out of Corregidor and reached Australia in April, sent out a request for some stuff. How that request got forwarded to America and bounced pinball-like through the cluttered infinitude of America's military and civilian bureaucracies. How the stuff in question was duly manufactured, procured, trucked hither and yon, and caused to be placed on a ship. And finally, some evidence to the effect that said ship was in Sydney Harbor several months ago. There's no evidence that this ship ever unloaded the stuff in question, but unloading stuff is what ships always do when they reach port, and so Comstock is going with that assumption for a while. After Major Comstock finishes his cigarette, he resumes his search. Some of the papers on his clipboard specify certain magic numbers that ought to be stenciled on the outside of the crates in question. At least, that's what he's been assuming since he started this search at daybreak, and if he's wrong, he'll have to go back and search every crate in Sydney Harbor again. Actually, getting a look at each crate's numbers means squeezing his body through narrow channels between crate piles and rubbing away the grease and grime that obscures the crucial data. The Major is now as filthy as any combat grunt. When he gets close to the end of the pier, his eye picks out one cluster of crates that appear to be all of the same vintage, insofar as their salt incrustations are of similar thickness. Down low, where the rain pools, their rough sawn wood has rotted. Up where it is roasted by the sun, it has warped and split. Somewhere these crates must have numbers stenciled onto them, but something else has caught his eye. Something that stirs Comstock's heart, just as the sight of the Star and Stripes fluttering in the morning sun might do for a beleaguered infantryman. Those crates are proudly marked with the initials of the company that Major Comstock and most of his comrades-in-arms up in Brisbane worked for before they were shunted en masse into the Army Signal Intelligence Service. The letters are faded and grimy, but he would recognize them anywhere in the world. They form the logo, the corporate identity, the masthead of ETC, the Electrical Till Corporation.